cooking something up with me.
Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Nathan Myhrvold doesn't exactly see food the way the rest of us do. When Martha Stewart was touring his home kitchen several years ago, she noticed a few unusual toys, including a machine that freezes food in 20 seconds, another machine that thaws food in 30 seconds, and a computer-controlled smoker that can barbecue a whole hog perfectly. Of course, Myhrvold also has a slightly different pedigree than most of us. He had a PhD in theoretical and mathematical physics by the time he was 23, studied with Stephen Hawking, and was chosen by Bill Gates to be chief technology officer of Microsoft. But his latest venture has been boiling down his six-volume work, Modernist Cuisine, into a guide for home cooks. Cooks who are as obsessed as he is with creating the perfect burger, the perfect French fry, the perfect omelet. Nathan Myhrvold is the author of Modernist Cuisine at Home. Nathan Myhrvold, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So let me first ask you, how did you get into cooking? What made you interested in it?
So I've been interested in cooking for as long as I can remember. When I was 9 years old, I announced to my mother I was going to cook Thanksgiving dinner all by myself. And I went shopping myself. I wouldn't let her in the kitchen. And I cooked Thanksgiving dinner. I have to go in the library and get lots of cookbooks. Now, I would do a better job of Thanksgiving dinner today, but it wasn't so bad it ever turned me off. So my whole life I was into it. While I was at Microsoft, I decided I wanted to go to chef school in France. So I got a leave of absence to do that. But the chef school wouldn't take me until I'd staged in a restaurant. So I worked one night a week in a French restaurant in Seattle for 2 years before I went to the chef school in France. And that combination of things gave me a real good grounding in the way traditional cooking was done. Then after I retired from Microsoft in 1999, I started doing a lot more cooking. And I realized that there was a whole set of new cooking techniques that were being done by a small set of the best chefs in the world. But there was no place to learn it. You know, if you went and you worked in one kitchen for a while, you might learn those three techniques. You worked in another kitchen, he'd have another five ideas that he had. But there was no big comprehensive book.
It was sort of the apprentice model. You had to be an apprentice to know things.
Absolutely. Which, of course, cooking is largely learned by apprenticeship. Still, even though there's cooking schools, it's still a big thing. So I resolved that I would write the big book. And it took me 5 years and I had to hire a whole team of people to help me finish it. But we created Modernist Cuisine, which is a 2,438-page, six-volume, 50-pound behemoth. That
it's big. It comes with its own shelf, is what you need to know.
While we were working the book, the joke was for some people it would be a coffee table book. For others, the coffee table itself.
That's right. Exactly. And I have to say, the home version, which is considerably smaller, is still – it's hefty. I don't know if you put – have you put this on the scale?
Yeah, it's about 10 pounds.
Okay. So it gave me a little bit of a workout when I got it and was looking through it and everything. So were you always interested in this sort of modernist version of cuisine, like looking at what was next, thinking about how you could use new tools to make kinds of food maybe we hadn't had before?
Well, I'm a huge fan of science and was a scientist. So when Harold McGee wrote his great book On Food and Cooking, that was in 1983, I loved that book. That really opened up my eyes and other people's eyes to the idea that science could be relevant. And then I've spent a career in technology where you always want to work on the next cool thing. And there's also a fundamental belief in technology that there is a new cool thing that's coming. So I gravitated towards aspects of cooking that required a technical understanding and that was new and innovative.
Now, when you either go out to eat or go to friends' houses, point me to a couple of dishes that you'd say, we cook the wrong way right now. We could cook them so much better.
Well, take a steak as a good example. So a steak, if you go to a steakhouse, they're really good at cooking steaks. There's some technical ways in which it would be better. But that's because the guy who's on the hotline cooking the steaks, he cooks thousands of steaks a week. He probably ruined a few hundred pounds of steak once in his career, but now he's past that and he's really, really good, he or she, although it's very grueling work. The problem, though, is even when you have an expert guy cooking the steak, when you cook it over high heat, you're going to have a band of gray overcooked meat at both sides of the steak. And then the interior might be the what you wanted. It might be rare, medium, right. whatever you wanted. If you want your steak medium rare, those two gray bands, which by volume can typically take 25 or even 30% of the volume of the overall steak, is overcooked. Which, at the price of steak, why should you put up with that? Well, if you cooked it using a technique called sous vide or a bunch of other techniques where you cook at low heat, you got to be a little more patient. It's going to take a while for you to cook that steak. But if you are more patient, the steak is perfectly cooked from edge to edge. Now, if you're not that expert, then your big concern in cooking steak is, oh, God, what if I undercook it or overcook it? You know,
right. And you bought a really expensive piece of meat.
And maybe the boss is over for dinner or your mother-in-law or somebody else, and you don't want to make a fool of yourself ruining this expensive piece of meat. And so there's a lot of angst that goes into it, because if you want it medium rare, that means you want the center of the steak to be about 130 degrees Fahrenheit. People's taste varies what they think medium rare means, but for me, medium rare is 130, maybe 135 for some folks. Meanwhile, you're cooking it with a gas flame or an electric oven or electric stove element, which is going to be 1,000 degrees, maybe 700 degrees. The surface of your pan is going to be 500 or 600 degrees. And so how do you get it to be just right in the middle? Well, by timing it exactly. And that's what that guy at the steakhouse spent a career learning how to do. You didn't spend a career. So we have a bunch of techniques. If you like equipment, there's something called sous vide, where you cook the food in a gentle bath of hot water that's maintained by a digital thermostat. These devices have gotten to be down to about $300. They're super convenient.
And you sort of have it sealed in this plastic
Typically,
bag,
you seal
right?
it in a plastic bag, but it turns out you can put it in a Ziploc bag. That works just fine, too.
Okay.
The hot water gently cooks it over a period of an hour or two. But then we developed a bunch of recipes in our book, so even if you don't have that. So one example is you can just make a big pot of hot water, or if you're camping or having a picnic, a big cooler. Fill it full of hot water at the right temperature, put the steaks in, let it sit for an hour or so, and then finish it in a super hot pan or on a grill just for a few seconds on each side to sear it.
So you're saying you're taking a steak, put it in a Ziploc bag, putting it in a bath of hot water, not super hot water, just somewhat hot water.
Right.
And leaving it in there for a while. And that's your way of cooking it.
And it turns out you can be pretty cavalier about the timing. You know, it's not a quick method, so it's going to take you, depending on the thickness of your steak, 30 minutes to an hour or two. But if you're a little bit early, a little bit late, there'll be no problem. So you don't know, all of the anxiety that comes from timing it goes away.
Okay, so I'm going to play a clip from when you were on the Colbert Report, and you gave him a pastrami that was cooked for a pretty long time. Let's listen.
So this is a water bath, and in here we have pastrami. We've been cooking this pastrami for 72 hours just for you.
Really?
Yes.
That seems like a really long time to cook anything. Well, what does a 72-hour pastrami taste like? Why would you do it this way?
You do it that way because you have control over the time and the temperature and the texture of the resulting food.
Well, it's only 130 degrees.
That's right.
Or am I going to die from eating this meat? That's just like leaving meat out in 130 degrees, like leaving a piece of beef out in August for 3 days, and now you want me to eat it.
Why don't we find out?
Let's find out. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
See? That's why we do it.
I don't need teeth. This is fantastic.
Nathan Myhrvold, author of Modernist Cuisine at Home. So there we had 72-hour pastrami. Yeah. So take me from the one-hour steak to, whoa, how did you get to 72 okay. hours?
So one of the things that makes meat tough is collagen. Collagen is a protein that's found in all of us, in all animals, and it's the primary thing in connective tissue. So when you cook meat for a long period of time, that collagen is modified, denatured is the technical term, into something called gelatin, which of course is what gives stews and stocks that unctuous kind of thing. It sets up afterwards, so it's the same gelatin you would make Jell-O out of. Now, normally the conventional cooking says, well, if I have a tough piece of meat, I need to cook it via braising it or stewing it or something for an hour to 3 hours. Typical braising time for short ribs might be 3 hours.
Right.
But that gives you a very overcooked piece of meat because you're cooking at pretty high temperature. Typically about 180 degrees would be a simmer that you'd use in braising. If you cook it at lower temperature, you can get that same tenderness, even perhaps higher degree of tenderness. That's why Stephen says that he didn't need teeth. It was so incredibly tender. But you do that without overcooking the meat. It still is cooked to a medium rare, medium kind of consistency.
So now if somebody didn't have a stove or whatever that stayed at, let's say, 100 degrees, which is...
You want a little higher than 100.
A little under. Okay, 130.
130.
Degrees. Okay. So what's the best way to do that at home? I mean, can you keep changing the water or...
That's something where if you're really going to do it for 3 days, you should get one of these sous vide machines.
Okay.
Because a sous vide machine has a digital thermostat and it will faithfully keep it at that temperature forever, basically. Improvising something like using a cooler full of water or a sink full of hot water, we've done that also. That will work if you're cooking it for 45 minutes to an hour. And so we've got a recipe for cooking salmon in your kitchen sink, because I talked about doing steak. For doing the 72-hour stuff, for that, you really ought to buy the sous vide machine. But then when you can take a cheap cut of meat, which also has a lot of flavor. Chuck roast is a good example. Short ribs are another example. They're way cheaper than filet mignon. But you cook them for, depending on the cut and what your effect you want, for 12 to 72 hours. And you get this piece of meat that is incredibly tender, much more tender even than the filet mignon. Hmm. It's still medium rare. And it actually has more flavor than a filet mignon. So it's both an economical, practical, and really delicious thing to do.
Now, when you talk about cooking things, whether it's salmon or beef in plastic, do you worry at all about chemicals that come out of plastic at high temperatures?
So not if you use the right plastic.
Okay.
There's different kinds of plastic. And high-quality plastics, plastic wraps such as Saran Wrap, Ziploc bags, for example, those are made of a plastic called polyethylene. That's also what's used in water bottles and lots of laboratory equipment. And it's the use in laboratory equipment that's interesting because it's been used for 20 years in laboratories, maybe even more. And if there was any chemicals leaching out, we'd know.
Okay.
Because it would mess up all these lab things. Now, that said, there are some people who say, I still don't want to do it, in which case you can actually cook most things you'd cook sous vide. You could cook in a mason jar. Hmm. If you'd prefer to put it in a glass jar, that's perfectly fine. A mason jar or a jar like that will work. Not so convenient for your T-bone steak, maybe, to put it in a jar. But there are some ways you can get around the plastic if you really care. But me, I don't care so long as it's polyethylene. Now, there are some really cheap plastic wrap, or there's some plastic bags that aren't made for food purposes that are made of PVC plastic. And those I wouldn't use because there is a possibility something could leach out of those.
Now, when you look through your book, you see recipes that are sort of, to somebody who's used to eating regular food, kind of fantastical. For example, I think of a striped mushroom omelet, which is stripes of mushroom puree and eggs. And I wonder, do you come up with those because you're thinking, what can I create that's really beautiful? Or because, you know, you're really trying to change the taste of the food that we eat? Where does that come from?
Well, that's mostly for aesthetics. It's for fun. One of the things that modern chefs do is they try to experiment and break some rules. You know, artists are always about breaking rules. There's no such thing as conformists who are artists, pretty much. Artists are about rule breaking, and that includes culinary artists. So in that case, when I had been to chef school in France, we learned how to make a striped cake called a biscuit jocond. And it's made with a special trick. And the trick is that you've got this special spatula with little rubber teeth on it. A little bit like the kind of trowel people use for putting the grout on for bathroom tile,
right,
actually. And so for this cake, you scrape this across a nonstick surface, leaving little stripes of one kind of cake batter. Then you put another batter on. Well, we started making omelets in the oven. It sounds like a strange way to make omelets, but if you can control the temperature of your oven, you can actually make an omelet much more reliably than you can on a stovetop. A stovetop, it's notoriously hard. In fact, it's one of the famous tests of a great chef. Well, most of us aren't great chefs in that way, so we developed this method of using an oven. And then I remembered this way of making the cake. I said, hey, let's make a striped omelet. Now, is there a reason to do it? Well, it tastes delicious because the texture is very good and because the mushroom puree that's in there that gives the color to the dark stripes tastes delicious. So it's a mushroom omelet. But really, it was done for fun. And it was because I, hey, let's make a striped omelet. No one's ever done that before. And it'll surprise people. And boy, it always does when we serve it.
And it's amazing looking. It's hard to believe that it's mushrooms and eggs striped. Do you think there's a revolution going on in food? Obviously, there have been different times when there was sort of a French school of cooking and an American school of cooking. Is modernism coming into food in a really big way?
Absolutely. You know, through the 20th century, and actually started in the 19th century, late 19th century, modernism came into many art forms. So we know what modern art is. And if you go to the Museum of Modern Art, you're going to see abstract art that's about rebelling against classical art, which, you know, there's a different museum usually in town. You can go to see that. And we know that's true with modern architecture. Here in Boston, if you look at the Strata Center that Frank Gehry designed at MIT, boy, that doesn't look like the more classical Corinthian and Doric columns that you find in other halls at MIT and Harvard
exactly.
And places. Well, that kind of spirit of rebelling against the past and doing things on an aesthetic basis is definitely coming to food. And there are modernist cooks around the world who are trying to push the edge of the envelope and do things that are different.
But is it just a few people around the edges? Do you see it at all trickling down into the way that we deal with food either at home or in sort of a typical restaurant?
If you look at the menus in what you call typical restaurants, you'd find that many of them are influenced by modernism.
Hmm.
So a number of years ago, actually going back now, probably 15 years ago, Ferran Adrià, a chef in Spain, started using foams. Now, of course, foams are what whipped cream is. Foam is what a bread is, actually. It's you don't think of it as a foam, but in fact, the yeast makes it rise, and that makes it sort of foam. Soufflé is a foam, and mousse. So classical cooking had lots of foams, but Ferran started using foams in lots of other unusual ways. You can find that in all kinds of restaurants now, where there'll be a dish that was served in a foamy kind of way in a savory context. Why? Because when you whip something up into a foam, it has a different texture. It has a different taste. Lots of people enjoy whipped cream on a dish where if you just gave them cream to drink, they probably wouldn't do it. Well, for the same reason, that's an example of the trickle-down, but sous vide, which is a technique that was originally used very extensively only by a very few chefs, has now trickled down to where you see sous vide things on the menu, sometimes labeled as such. Sometimes if they're a little bit more cautious, they didn't label it that way, but that's how they're cooking it because it's a very practical way to get a kind of cooking that you just couldn't get any other way.
Now, when you were creating the original Modernist Cuisine book, I know you brought in chefs right from all over the world, came to work in your big kitchen that you had built. Do you still spend time in that big old research kitchen that has tons of tools?
Yeah, absolutely.
You do?
Yeah. Well, there's people who show up to work there every day.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
So even though the book is done, they're still...
Well, we're promoting... After our first book, we did our second book. We're still doing a bunch of promotional things for the second book. And who knows? Maybe there'll be a third book or something else that we do going forward.
Do you think cooking is going to be a big part of your life? I mean, I know you've obviously done stuff with Microsoft. You've done all sorts of things. Do you see cooking as being still part of this stage and the next stage of your life?
Well, cooking has been with me for longer than almost any other interest. So I was 9 when I started to cook. I certainly didn't program computers when I was 9. They didn't have them then. they did, but not the way we do today. So it's always been a part of my life and always will be. The thing that's amazing to me is I took something that was just my amateur passion and I turned it into something that's sort of part of my career now. The Modernist Cuisine books, the two that we've out so far, have just been a fantastic thing for me because I start off somebody nobody knew, an amateur chef. Yeah, I'd gone to chef school and so forth. But who was I to tell famous cooks how to cook? They call me up and ask advice now.
And I know you have pictures in your book of you got this machine where you can cut things like microwaves and blenders. Just cut it in half. Is it a chainsaw that you bought? And you just cut these things in half and figured, I'm going to figure out how this works.
So my company has a whole laboratory that we invent new technology, and this laboratory is where we build our prototypes. And we took a corner of it, and we made it into the food lab. And because we have a whole machine shop, we couldn't cut anything in half, pretty much. And early in the process of making the book, I hit on that as a way of showing people what was going on inside their food, inside their pots and pans, inside their appliances while they cook. You know, the old question, is that light in the refrigerator still on when the door's shut?
Right.
Well, how could you tell the door's shut? Well, the answer to that and many, many other things are made a lot more clear if you can show people. And I thought briefly that, well, we'll have illustrations. I thought, no, let's actually cut things in half so that people can really see what's happening. See what's happening inside a steak while you cook it, or inside a pot of water that's boiling, or when you're steaming broccoli or some such. Over time, we've gotten to cut all kinds of things in half. We got a big, brand new, beautiful stove from Viking.
Oh, no. And you cut it in half.
We cooked with it for like 6 months, and then we cut it in half. And it's a little bit like the kid at the 4-H thing that takes the baby calf and raises up, and oops, it has to go to market.
But we're talking about like a $10,000 stove, right?
Yeah.
That you cut in half. Okay. are there a couple of dishes, whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever the dish, that you just like the old way and have not tried in any way to update because you sort of like it with all its flaws? There's a sentimental value to it.
Well, you know, food means a lot of things to people. We have a very intimate relationship with food. When people don't like food, they're more offended than if they don't like architecture, or they don't like the clothes you're wearing, and they don't like some other thing. If you offend them with food they don't like, it's a big thing. It's probably safer to offend them with politics or religion than it is to offend folks with food. So if you've got a favorite way you like something, by all means, eat it that way. I can't think off the top of my head of something where I like it cooked badly, but I certainly grew up eating some foods, and I like having those foods, at least some rendition of what that was like, even if I know there might be other ways of eating it. So yeah, I'm like that too.
Are there a couple of favorite foods that you can think of that these are just some of my favorite dishes?
More than a couple.
Okay.
But I think that the most important thing is for people to connect with what they feel is, you know, in our book, we tried to make the ultimate hamburger, the ultimate pizza, the ultimate. Well, you can't say ultimate pizza to people and have them all agree, because if you grew up on a thin crust New York style pizza that you bought by the slice at the neighborhood, that's going to be your touchstone. Whereas if you grew up in Naples, you might have a very different idea of what a pizza is. And if you grew up in Chicago, you say, well, it's got to be at least an inch thick, right? This deep dish, which is wonderful too. They're all wonderful foods, but they're very, very different.
Nathan Myhrvold, author of Modernist Cuisine at Home, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. Remember, you can hear any of this week's segments or any of our past shows by subscribing to our podcast at wgbh.org/innovationhub. And you can also follow us on Twitter at @WGBHInnovate. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.
Hey, good looking. What you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?